make a walk with me, not like you used to do. Do something different, and put yourself in other people's shoes. Open up your mind and open up your eyes and change your direction, change your perspective.
Welcome into Other People's Shoes. I am your host, Neil Matthews. Thank you so much for hitting play today. Super excited that you've joined me today. Also excited about tomorrow. Anybody else feeling a little bit grateful, a little bit thankful? By the way, what is your favorite? You can let me know, maybe at opspodcast.com or on our social medias, OPS Podcast Show, a little different, but kind of the same, under our social medias, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Let me know what your favorite Thanksgiving dish is. Now, mine is maybe not that weird. Like, I've heard some people say, you know, it's the sweet potatoes. Okay. All right. I see you there. But mine really is truly the stuffing. And I know this is going to sound weird to some. I'm not a big turkey fan. I love the ham. I don't know why. And I know ham's kind of the Christmassy thing. But anyway, I digress to say this. Isn't it great when we can gather around the table with family? Now, I lead into that to say this. I met this guy about 2 years ago, roughly, maybe almost three now. I don't know. We don't have like a friendiversary or anything like that. Like, I don't know the date we became friends or best friends, you know. I do know the date, you know, like my wife and I started dating, we got married. I know all those dates, but like this guy, I don't know our friendiversary. So I may have to put research on that. But he tells me in conversations, he said, "Hey, I know you're always looking for a good guest." And I said, "You are absolutely right, Mr. Sean McCoy. I am always looking for someone to come to my table. I mean, wait, try on their shoes." That was his show, little joke there. And he says, "You know, I think you should interview my sister." And I was like, "What? No, come on. Your sister? Like, what? No, I don't know. I don't really." He's like, "Listen, she has this amazing story and I think you're going to love it, but it also might break your heart all at the same time." And I said, "Well, now you have me intrigued, my friend. You know the words to say. So help me welcome from the great state of Texas, Sean's sister, Heather." Heather, how are you today?
Oh, I'm good. Happy gobble gobble.
Isn't that a great introduction? Like, what a way to like build this dramatic house that people tease me about building all the time, just to say we have Sean McCoy's sister.
I know. You know, and it's very funny because it's the continuation from growing up as being Sean's sister, that when people find out that I'm Sean's sister, they're like, "Ooh, you're Sean's sister?" I'm like, yeah, the one and only. And it got me far in high school, I can tell you that.
Well, I feel like there's a lot of expectations that come with that too. Being the little brother of Corey, which is my brother, I was in band, shamefully admitting, and he was a senior. And not only was he a senior in band, but he was the drum major of the band.
Yeah.
You know, he not only got to tell me what to do on the football field as far as like marching and things of that nature, but he also got to tell me when I got home all the bad stuff I was doing wrong and making him look bad on said football field and in his band world.
Right.
Because he was the king of his castle.
Right. And you were a reflection of him, the extent.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. You follow me.
Yes.
So I feel like we have a little bit of that going on.
I got
right
you.
Now. Maybe a little bit.
I totally get the younger sibling thing and trying to, but fortunately me being a girl and Sean being a guy, I didn't have too much to keep up with, you know, because I was the better, stronger sibling anyway. He might've been more intelligent, but I was the super jock of the family. So.
So just to clarify, you are the better athlete than your brother.
I was when I was in high school. Now.
No. We could still say is. It's fine.
This man just turned around and just rode his mountain bike from like, I think it was from freaking Maryland all the way through Philadelphia, and like with a hurricane that came through freaking Ian, and he's still going for it, he and his buddy. And I was like just sitting there eating like freaking gummies and shit, watching their legacy. And I was like, that is amazing. Good job, Sean. Way to go, bro.
I did FaceTime him at one point. He was somewhere. I can't even remember where. And it was the reception was so poor. I just got this really, and I should have screenshotted it in hindsight. Your phone freezes.
Yeah.
And it's always at the most inopportune,
yes,
like weirdest face you're doing. Like it's almost like Apple knows.
Yeah.
I love your brother. One day I will meet him. And people find that so hilarious. My brother-in-law, speaking of brothers, my brother-in-law, one of my best friends from high school, and his brother. So the three of them went to Houston last year and actually met your brother. And then they FaceTimed me at dinner
just to kind of
while they were at dinner with your brother, like, "Hey, we've met Sean McCoy now. You haven't. You suck. And you're in Oregon and not in Houston right now." With
Ryan,
me,
so. Sean needs to do one of those like surprise.
I keep telling him, come to Oregon.
And just like knock on your door and like totally fangirl you. It's great.
That would, That would be fun. We should set that up. Anyway, I'm sure people didn't come here to hear our fangirl and fandom of your all things Sean McCoy. Yeah. I'm sure people are bored and fast forward through this, but that's okay. But Heather, help us with this, because I love to lead off every show with this question. And that's this: what style of shoes do you love to wear?
Technically, it's a Skechers slipper with memory foam and lots of fur around the ankles. That's my preferred style of shoe. Just comfy, durable. I have no shame wearing it to the Dollar General right up the store, or I'll be that Walmartian that you see and people take pictures of. I have no shame, none at all. If I could wear it in the office, I'd do that too. Otherwise, it's a nice fine sneaker.
That's fun. Yeah, boots with the fur. That's what I'm envisioning right now. I don't know.
Yeah,
but maybe quite not a lot of boot, right?
Yeah, it's super comfy. It's incredibly warm. So considering I'm up here in North Texas, you know, anything north of 10 is considered a Yankee, but I'm scratching on Oklahoma right now. So it's about 35, 40 degrees right now. Yeah, we had our first snow kind of like warning over the weekend. So I was like, this is great, you know, coming from Houston. We're all excited.
Getting into you, we're in this walk-away season, walk-away stories. But Heather, help us with this. Like, that walk-away moment for you was what?
That walk-away moment was about... It started 6.5 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. It started when I almost died from suicide because I was so incredibly fermented with alcohol and depression, despair. I believed in my mind that nobody would miss me or I would be better. Everybody else would be better without me here. When you saw me 6.5 years ago or even longer, you would look at me thinking there's absolutely no way that she has a problem. That why would she have a problem? She's married. She's got 2.5 kids. She's got the house and the cars and the six-figure job and everything. But I couldn't have been more freaking miserable and alone and battered and depressed and just hopeless than I was at that point in time in my life. And I had been through several other circumstances with drugs, heavy drugs in my early 20s, and severe like physical and mental abuse, but nothing compared to where I was in my marriage with my husband, going through up into this spot to the point where I just didn't want to do it anymore. And the alcohol made it to where it was telling me that, yeah, it would be the best thing for you to go, because the disappointment in my family, the disappointment, the things that my ex-husband would say to me, you start believing it after a while. You start feeling that there was a reason why he said that and you must be bad. There is a reason why he cheats on you. There's a reason why he hurts you. There's a reason why, because you're not pretty enough. You're not skinny enough. You're not making enough money. Like, you have all these scenarios that go through your mind. When you would see me outside of my house, you would never know. Most people have a stigmata of what alcoholics are supposed to look like. They're supposed to look like that person underneath the bridge. You're supposed to look like that person that's standing on the corner and begging for change, or, you know, pretending that they have sick and kids and just need to eat a meal. But it's not. They look like me. They look like you. They have functioning jobs. I never lost a job when I was heavily in my addiction. I never had a speeding ticket, never got arrested. So when I was in treatment, that was some of the stories that I would hear all the time. And I had to really reflect of, like, am I really as bad as they? I never got arrested. I never prostituted myself. I never. When I started to really stop trying to talk myself out of what I really was and really just sat long enough, and most people would be shocked that I actually didn't talk as much, because that's really funny for me not to talk. I sat and listened, and one of the things that they say in the rooms is, don't compare your story to what is different with yours. Look at the similarities of where it is and what you're doing and what happened and where you started to how you got through it and where you are now.
First off, thanks for sharing that. I think, to me, that is what I've heard from many recovering addicts, is the fact that they start playing my story is not as bad as JoJo. My story is not as bad as Susie, whatever. And to me, it's fascinating to me that even as people who aren't quote unquote in recovery play that game. We play, well, you've done this. Well, I've done that. Mm-hmm. Well, you've done that. You know, it turns into almost this measuring contest.
For sure.
And it's so stupid that we as humans do that, but I have not encountered anybody that hasn't on some level been a part of that or been privy to that in some way.
Yeah.
But you mentioned kind of this double life, almost it felt like. Maybe I'm interjecting or putting words in your mouth. If I am, obviously, correct me. This may sound kind of silly. Recently, my wife had a get together at her work and she decided to make macaroni and cheese in our crock pot. And she decided to do pulled pork with the macaroni and cheese. By the way, it was fantastic.
Sounds amazing.
So good. It was so amazing.
It sounds like a warm hug from the inside. I'm saying macaroni and cheese is my thing for sure.
The aftermath was maybe not the great job. And so those who have cooked in crock pot probably know this better than I do. After she got the food cleaned out and the excess food, it had like kind of crusty nastiness from the resident food, you know, and it was really gross. And it had been like baked on, caked on kind of thing, you know, because it's a crock pot. It never really kind of stopped cooking.
Yeah, inside the element.
Exactly,
thing,
huh? Right. And so yeah. It's like now crusted around it and it's now like starting to kind of stink and kind of have this aroma that isn't as warm of a hug as you mentioned, you know, with the
exactly
with the macaroni yeah. cheese and the pulled pork. This is like a Friday night, get it back, the crock pot. And so now it's Saturday morning and I'm getting up to go play pickleball with some friends and the crock pot is just nasty. I can see it. And so my Saturday chore is to do the dishes. That's the husbandly thing that I've committed to doing.
Oh, that's nice. I wonder what that's like.
Yeah.
I've never had that.
You should look into that. I guess it's pretty amazing. I don't know. You should look into that.
That would be one day in my next life, I guess.
Right?
I'll get one like you.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not that great.
You had me at dishes. I'm like, oh my God, you should.
I had you at dishes. That's funny. But I say that because I knew, you know, I knew what I was coming back to when I got done playing pickleball. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get ahead of this. I'm going to do it right now. It's 6 a.m. Granted, everyone in the house is sleeping. So I'm trying to be like quiet as I'm like scraping this, you know, crock pot out, trying not to gag, shoving all this stuff down the garbage disposal, making it, you know, as pretty as possible. And I was so kind of proud of myself. This is me bragging a little bit as a husband. Like I finally got it clean and I put it back in its little, you know, container where it does its warming stuff and all that. And I was like, that thing is back to normal. Again. All right. Clean the outside, clean the inside. We're good to go. And so I come home from pickleball. My wife has already created another creation for the crock pot. I thought, okay, it must have been pretty clean because she's now using it again.
Right.
Because to me, from the outside looking in or from the outside, the crock pot was fine.
Right.
There was no issue with it. You would have never known that there was all that nastiness, all that gross, corroded, smelling, pungent, whatever you want to say wrong. You would have never known. What was it for you that you finally said, okay, I'm going to have to get in here with the scraper and start scraping some of these bad behaviors out, scraping some of this nastiness in my life out?
For me, it was the night that I tried to kill myself and my son was around 13 years old. My daughter was 15, going on 16. I had fractured my tailbone like the month before. My husband wasn't coming home. And when he would come home, it was terrible. The kids would hide. My mom would hide. And then when I fractured my tailbone, one of the things that my doctor told me was, you know, a little bit of red wine can go a long way and help you with your circulation. And I was like, thank you. That's all I needed to know. So I literally just would get bottles of wine. And needless to say that I couldn't go very far. It's not like how alcoholics don't know how easy they have it now, or they can just call it up on an app and have it delivered to the house. They don't know the panic about trying to drive to the store, which you shouldn't. Don't drink and drive. You know, it was my turn. I was hurt and I needed my husband and I needed him. I needed somebody. Nobody was there. I did everything. I was the first person to sacrifice myself for you, for anybody else that needed. I was there, the first person to be there, the last person to clean up and everything in between. Very similar to like your story here. But when I needed somebody, I had no one. Now, mind you, one of the hardest things, not even just for people who are alcoholics, just for people in general, is to just, you know, pick up a freaking phone and say, you know, I'm not in a good place and I need to freaking talk. Because for some reason, we all have the pride that we all have to have our shit together. And if we don't, then we're weak. You know, you've got the tea on you. It's something. It becomes such a faux pas when you're struggling. And I was no different. And I wouldn't call, but I was waiting. I was just waiting for people. And nobody showed up. And so I just started drinking to the point where I was starting to go through through seizures if I didn't drink. I had really bad sores and everything in my mouth because of how much vitamin deficiency that I had. And I don't really remember too much about the night. I remember parts of it because I had been on a 2-week drinking. Basically, I would never sleep. I would just pass out long enough to where I would wake up in such an anxiety panic and shaking so bad. I had to find alcohol in order for me to be normal. It was just a cycle. It would never stop. I don't even remember looking at myself during that time. I just remember where I was trying to kill myself, and I just was like ripping my hair out of my head. I just remember beating myself in the face with a brush, and it was just, I just remember talking about how bad I hated myself, and my kids were there. My daughter literally had to sit on me, and my son went downstairs to his father. My husband was downstairs. The majority of this just completely ignored me, wouldn't help me at all. And my son had to go down there and ask him, "Dad, I need help my mom. Please help my mom." And he said no. He said he wouldn't. And so my kids had to make a decision at 13 and 15. I still get very choked up about the positions I put my kids in, about making them grow up too fast, too quickly. My kids called an ambulance for me to come and go. I didn't fight. If anything, I was relieved. I finally had somebody coming for me. I finally had somebody besides my kids trying to make sure that I'm eating, because I stopped eating. I stopped drinking water. It was all alcohol. Just the despair of how bad I hated myself. Like, why was I not important enough for somebody to just care about? It was always, what can I do for you? And what can you take from me? But when I needed something, there was no bother to it. And I just had enough. And I just didn't want to be here. I just didn't want to suffer any longer. And I just figured that my kids would be better without me. You get into that place where you start feeling that lie, and it doesn't stop. Once you get into that motion and your mind is repetitive, and then your mind won't shut off. And then it continues. And it wasn't until I was in the emergency room, gone through several bags of banana bags, trying to get me somewhat coherent. And then they wanted to send me home. I wouldn't leave. I wouldn't leave until I talked to a psychiatrist, because there was something. I was using the alcohol to make me prettier and funnier and dance better, sexier, all this stuff. I would always joke to people and say, yeah, it's supposed to do all this for me. But, you know, I saw the video and it's not cute anymore. Like when you're in your 20s and you're like, woo, you know, I did all this and I danced like that. Woo. You know, by the time that you get to be like in your late 30s and 40s, that's when people are like, yeah, you got a problem. You got a problem. But nobody would ever say that to me. Nobody would ever tell me. My ex-husband would just put bottles of alcohol in front of me when I would try to quit on my own, and would just do that all the time. And then just don't buy liquor. Just buy wine. Don't buy wine. Just buy beer. You know, just trying to do that. Yeah, it was when I really started putting my brain together when I was in the emergency room, and I tried to go through this process many times before. My ex-husband would not allow me because it was too embarrassing for him and his side of the family to have me in such a place. I'm not, as my ex-father-in-law would say, I am not that kind of person to be in a place like that. Once I turned around and realized I was exactly that kind of person, and I needed to be in that place, because otherwise I would be dead.
Again, I applaud your ability to share that, because again, I don't know. I just think there's so much power in hearing somebody's story. There just is. And I hope your kids would hear this and others would hear this and say, okay, mom was in a really bad place and mom was really hurting. I want to ask you about this quote. Mark Twain is attributed to saying this. So again, I always say this because I don't know. I didn't hear him say it, but he is attributed to saying this. And it says, the worst loneliness is not being comfortable with yourself. When you hear that, what comes to mind?
I was that person. I mean, that's something for so many of us, because like I tell people now, like after my divorce, I have not dated. I've not talked to anybody, because I might be alone, but I'm not lonely, because I'm content with the one person that I should be in absolute head over heels in love with. And it's myself. And it's one of those cliches that we hear about so much where, you know, I was the first person to sacrifice myself for others. And once I realized that you don't need to sacrifice, you shouldn't have to sacrifice yourself for people to love you. Give and give and give. And I was such that person all the time when I was a kid. You know, my mother drank. My father was very, very upset all the time. My mom would drink because my dad was upset. My dad was upset because my mom drank. You know, it was just such a cycle. And I would try to do everything I could to try to make both of them happy. So I was an overachiever. There's different layers of people when they start diagnosing you what kind of person you are. I'm the overachiever. I am the one that always has to make things perfect and just the perfectionist and everything. Once I just really just kind of let it hang out and be like, you know what? I am tired of being my ex-husband's trophy. I'm tired of being the American woman that he married and trying to turn me into a Honduran wife, because I'm not. And it almost killed me trying to do that. I embraced everything about his culture, embraced his music, his food, his everything, is family. But when it came to me, he would say things to me like, oh, you don't understand because you're white. Couldn't change the color you married. I mean, it didn't make any sense to me. I just got tired of, A, waiting for him to take the ownership of his narcissism, what he would say to me. And when I finally got sick and tired of waiting for that other shoe to drop, I mean, I was in treatment. When I got done with the ER, I ended up going into a detox center for 2.5 weeks, which was a very interesting situation. It was co-ed. There were some really interesting people. Needless to say, I kept a pencil in my hair that I would put it up in like a bun, but I was actually using it just in case somebody came too close to me, and if I need to stab them with it, I had to. From there, that's when I really started to just like cry, because I remember this one time when I was going through this one process, and they gave me basically a picture of like an oval. You're supposed to make your mask. The way that I did mine kind of looked like a Fabergé egg. They were asking me to explain it. And I said, well, when you look at a Fabergé egg, when you look at something beautiful, you don't even think twice about it. You marvel about it. It's so glorious. It's beautiful. But what happens when that egg gets ticked off that pedestal and it cracks just like freaking Humpty Dumpty? I had nobody putting me back together. Nobody. And I'm just as pretty, but I am just so broken and fragile as that damn egg. And there was nobody there to put me back together except for myself. I had to stop depending on other people to make me important. That was the biggest thing. I was waiting for my dad. I was waiting for my brothers. I was waiting for my mother. I was waiting for my friends. I was waiting for my husband. I mean, freaking everybody. Every time I wasn't important to somebody, I was just like, well, what the hell is the point to all this? And a lot of it has to be like what you just said. I had no idea who I was or what I was or what I liked, or was it just because I liked this because I'm influenced by this person? Because I didn't want people to not like me. So I liked everything. I never told people no. I was always yes. And when I started telling people no, that's when people started looking at me differently. When I was like, no, I don't want to go to this dinner because I don't want to be around alcohol. It's going to make me feel uncomfortable. My ex-husband would get furious with me. You can't do that. You can't tell people that you're not going because there's alcohol there and it's just not going to make you feel comfortable. I'm like, why the hell not? If these are my friends and family, if they truly care about what it is, they will respect the fact that it's not making me feel very comfortable. Maybe one day, but not today. And I need you as my husband and the person who's supposed to stand there beside me to understand that you just shouldn't make people feel bad because you have a problem. I don't have a problem. They don't have a problem. It's you. It's your fault. You have the problem. And I would hear that over and over and over all the time. And when I finally got pissed enough where I was like, you know what? I'm tired of making excuses for everybody else to make me feel better about myself. Do you want to go? Freaking go. I'm not going. When I got tired of consequences or waiting for the shoe to drop, what is going to happen to me? What is going to happen with all this? And I started really, really, truly enjoying just like freaking hanging out with myself, really starting to understand how I got to the point where I was and where I am now. It's relieving. I mean, there's a saying that I've said before, and it goes kind of along with this, where we're all on a path of a river. And there's two kinds of people when it comes to this kind of river. Are you part of the team that's going to ride the rapids with you? Are this going to be part of the team that's going to try to dam the river and try to control the flow? And if anybody's ever been around a flood knows, eventually that river will win and that dam will break. I appreciated the people who stay around with the river, or the people who were just part of the rocks of the flow of my rapids and to where I'm in calmer waters now. It's heartbreaking on a lot of things because I never wanted my marriage to end. I never wanted a 20-year relationship to end. I had to put my sobriety first, not him. And it's not a marriage if you're the only one in it too.
That's some of the hardest part about relationships is you got really two different people mm-hmm. coming together, living together, mm-hmm. cohabitating. I know at least in my marriage, 21 years, I brought my stuff into the marriage.
Yeah.
I brought my brokenness into the marriage. I brought the way I was raised into the marriage. She brought the way she was raised into the marriage. She's not broken. She's, you know, Mary Poppins. She's practically perfect in every way, some would say, and some have said. You know, the reality is that, you know, when you have broken people coming together, generally brokenness still happens, yeah. unfortunately, you know, and that's the sad part about relationships. Walking through some recovery efforts, some things of that nature, I'm imagining, again, I've been through some of that myself, not necessarily the AA variety, but some recovery efforts mm-hmm. and some past stuff that I've walked through. And I know for me, at least, there was an emphasis or at least an element of a higher power, a higher purpose, because you have to have this higher purpose other than yourself.
Yeah.
Did you experience anything like that? And if so, maybe how does that play a part in your story?
For sure. My higher power and I, whether it be God, whether it be the universe, just something bigger than myself. I was not raised religious at all. My mom was raised Catholic, but no religion whatsoever in our household. The idea of God or any of that was at the foremost, looked down upon. When it came to try to figure out how I could believe into something bigger and better than myself, I just started thinking about my grandparents that had passed away. And like, I had guardian angels always watching over me. So I would talk to them. Like, I didn't understand. Like, I didn't understand why I had to suffer so greatly. I'm a good person. Like, I'm the coolest chick ever. Like, I am fun. I cook. I did all this stuff. I worked hard. I brought home the bacon, and I knew how to like take a big pork belly and I could make my own damn bacon. You know what I mean? It's, I didn't understand why I had to suffer so greatly. But one of the things I found out is that it's not for me to understand why. The only way that we as people can really truly understand and grow is we do have to suffer. I don't understand why. I mean, why can't we just take the freaking good advice and just run with it? Because we don't want to be told what to do. We don't want to be told how we're supposed to live. But I tell you what, once I started reading the big book of AA, I almost felt like I was reading like the never end of freaking story. I seriously thought I had freaking Falcor, the dragon somewhere near me, and I had a narrator, you know, freaking Columbo, narrating my life story. Insanely creepy reading this document, these pages from 1934, and it was exactly what I was experiencing in 2016. I mean, it was transcending. I mean, how can somebody understand? And honestly, the only step that talks about alcohol in the 12 steps of AA is the first one, is that we're powerless over it. Now, you can interject anything with that. You can interject, I am powerless over freaking Oreo cookies. I am powerless over vanilla shakes or smoking or sex or any of that stuff. If people turned around and really looked at that and really did, it's amazing what you turn around and reflect. And it's just hard for people to be humble enough to say, I freaking screwed up, but how do I make it bigger and better? How do I make myself better? And I was told to let go of control. That was the key thing that was told to me, was to let go of control.
You mentioned, again, walking through that and learning some valuable lessons, obviously, about yourself and realizing that, you know, maybe sometimes it is a higher power or a higher purpose that can kind of walk you through that hell that you went through. You know, I would imagine your ex-husband, I would imagine there was a lot of verbal, maybe physical abuse as well that probably pushed you more towards drinking and type of issue and that type of lifestyle, if you will, if that's a lifestyle.
Yeah, it's a type of lifestyle. You get addicted to it, and you get addicted to the whole pageantry of everything as well. Yeah.
But you mentioned your kids. You mentioned them seeing you probably, I would imagine, at your worst. Probably can't think of another worst moment that the kids have probably seen you in, right?
Right.
Now going forward, I mean, you mentioned 2016, that's kind of when the apex of this really awful moment happened. So with all that being said, what do you really hope as a mom that your kids have learned from you after not only seeing you at your worst to now? what do you hope that they take away from your life?
That anything is possible if you work hard enough and you stay the course of it. And when you stumble, you really speak up and ask for help. And one of the biggest things that I wanted to give my kids is to let them know that I'm not superhuman. I might be your mother, but I didn't have the support that I'm able to give them now. And being as vulnerable and real and honest and translucent with them, the transparency with my kids now is amazing. With my son has been diagnosed as bipolar schizophrenic, and we've been fighting for his life over a year now, where I almost lost him a year ago multiple times. And his dad lived like 2 miles away from us. And in the 5 years that we were gone, you know, he never even came by to like really, I think he stopped by maybe 2 or 3 times in like 4 years that we lived literally in walking distance from each other. Never saw his daughter. The one time that they did see each other in 2019 was just for a few hours. And then the buzz was over, so to speak. The thing about it is, when it comes to people who haven't truly reflected or taken ownership, they've actually turned around, not only dished out, but served up and taken a big spoonful, is you almost have this empathy for people who don't understand how freeing it is if you literally just let it go. Like, is it really going to be that freaking serious at the end of the day because somebody didn't say thank you because you opened up the door for them? Like, if somebody opens up the door for you, you know, and you say thank you, that's amazing. But just because somebody opens up the door for you, it is polite to say thank you, but it's not the end of the world if they don't. I can't tell you how many times that I've seen people open up the door, somebody doesn't say thank you. Well, you're so welcome. I mean, like, why be so angry? And that's one of the greatest things about becoming sober, finding my higher power, becoming a lot more connected with who I am. It's just the freaking peace, you know, just I go to sleep not having to have any medication to help me go to sleep. That alone, that alone was worth it. I mean, that alone, being able to remember what I did the night before, not being terrified of who I texted in the middle of the night or called, or what the hell did I say to them, or being accused from my ex-husband that supposedly I did something with somebody the night before when I didn't. And here I am asking my kids if they saw it. I mean, like, I shouldn't have to justify myself all the time. And my kids being 22 and 20, like my daughter does drink. She will talk to me about it. I cannot transcend myself and what my problem was onto my kids. I'm a lot more fearful of my son because he does have a lot that's going on with him. And if anybody knows anybody who struggles with that kind of mental ailment, it's a lot more than just, I'm just a little blue. It is literally life and death every day if the medication isn't taken and if you mix things along with it. My daughter started going through a type of recovery as well, because when I was in my worst, she was in hers as well. She was cutting. She was acting out in a way, the despair. She thought of suicide multiple times as well. When I finally, as they say in Texas, pulled up my bootstraps, put on my big girl panties, basically, and I finally told my ex-husband that I was done. I was just done being an accessory, no less than an ornament on a Christmas tree. I wasn't anywhere. I was not even part of the Christmas tree. I was just barely an ornament. I wanted to be the star on the top. I remember taking my kids' hands and my mom and was like, I'm done. We don't have to live like this anymore. I don't know where we're going to go or how we're going to do it, but all I know is it's going to get better. And I don't care if I have to eat ramen noodle soup and the rest of us for years so we can survive, but at least we don't have to deal with this shit anymore. I want you to understand that this is not the way that it's supposed to be. And we're supposed to have each other back for real. We're supposed to love each other for real, tell each other that we're full of shit for real, and not be afraid to have an opinion. My kids, I've raised them as young people and not as to be seen and not heard and not to be my slave, because that was how my ex-husband was. You know, he would whistle at them like dogs to have them run up and bring him food and all the rest of this. And if it wasn't made with enough love, he wouldn't eat it. Like, who does that shit to people? And I just got tired of him treating me, my kids, like crap. And I finally put myself first. And I didn't need a man any longer. I never needed him. I wanted him. I never needed him because I can make my own money. I can do my own things. But when I finally realized that I didn't need validation from him to be important or amazing, look or feel good, it's amazing what it can do. I mean, not even just for a woman, but even for a man looking for that validation from others, whether it's your family, whether it's your friends, whether it's your spouse, whether whoever it is, you don't need their validation to exist. It feels good. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's great to have somebody like, oh, you look great. But once we truly understand that there's something so amazingly unique about you and you don't need to be other people like you see on social media and everything, it's okay to be yourself. You can be as goofy as you want, or you can, you know, do whatever you need to. My advice with the alcohol was it almost killed me, and I'm terrified of it. And I also got told that relapse doesn't have to be part of my story. Terrified of that because I was in treatment, and I would have all these people. This is my fourth time in rehab. This is my seventh time in rehab, and I'm just looking around. I was like, why the hell would you want to? This is painful. It's expensive. What the hell? But I did do everything that my counselor told me. I not only did the detox and I did the 30 days in treatment, but I also went to a sober woman's house. It's one thing to dry the hell out, but it's another of like barely getting your kids out of potty training and throwing them out there. Be like, go ahead, you know, the bathroom's somewhere, just, you know, just make sure you get to it. I mean, it was truly impactful. I had to get, and I remember talking to my kids about this because my daughter would cry. My son would cry about being at home alone because their dad would just, I'm gone, you know, trying to get myself together for real this time. And their dad would just never be there, and they're alone. And fortunately, my mother lived with them, but he would be gone for days. He would be gone for days. And they're like, Mom, we need you to come home. And I'm like, I know your meemaw's there. If I don't do this and if I don't go through it completely, I don't want to do this again because I don't think I'd come back. And I can't do that. I can't do that to y'all. I can't do that to me. You know, I can't do that to other people because, you know, one of the biggest things is how selfish people get. We get so freaking selfish, and the manipulation and the lying and everything else that goes along with it. I mean, shit, if alcoholics and addicts really got our shit together and did all this amazing shit that we do for the greater good, oh my God, it's amazing what we could do. Somebody said, what was it that my dad said, that God invented whiskey so the Irish wouldn't take over? Something like.
But Heather, let me ask something. You mentioned your dad.
Yeah.
I would imagine, just by reading the room, I'm imagining that if you're growing up with feeling like I need to do more, validate, see me, achieve, you probably didn't have a lot of love from dad, which in turn, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I am not Dr. Neil. But imagine even in relationships in high school, post high school, whatever, that you probably sought out people to try to validate those feelings you never got from dad. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm right. I don't know. But how much would it have meant to you to hear at 6, at 10, at 13, at 16, at 20, your dad put his arm around you, maybe kiss you on the cheek and say, Heather, I love you. I'm proud of you. What would that have meant to you?
Oh, it would have meant everything. You know, and now looking back, you know, I understand my dad did the best that he could. Raising a girl, a lot of people don't understand just emotionally needing. I mean, people talk about it, but there's girls really, and boys do too, but girls especially, we search and we desire that safety and that security and that validation that, you know, we're doing okay. We're all right. I mean, there's things that I can remember. I still can remember that my dad said to me when I was like 4 and 5 years old. It was terrible, you know, but then again, when I thought it was terrible, of course, when you tell people that that's terrible, they're like, oh, you just don't know how to take a joke, you know, and not understanding how that truly hurts somebody's feelings and don't understand how that can really like navigate the self-esteem of a child. Truly back in the 80s, you know, most people that being called a whale, being called brontosaurus butt and thunder thighs, and just question, oh, you're going to eat that again, and starting to develop eating disorder because I'm so tall and so big in like elementary and junior high, and I'm walking and people doing like FIFA for faux fum and stuff. And it's just, you become so self-aware internalized that the very first time that anybody pays attention to you, like a guy, or like for a guy, for, you know, a girl or whatever, whatever you decide, you just are complete and utter shock. And you have this image in your mind of what you seem to look like. And then when people are telling you that you're not, you're just like, something's wrong with you. You're like, you downplay what they say because you don't ever feel you deserve it because you never got it when you were younger. Like, some of that was a hard lesson. A lot of it really caused a lot of the damage, but you know, my dad's better now, and I can tell him that it hurts my feelings or something. And but it's hard because you don't want to, it's hard to tell the people, especially the men in your life that you love, or the women in life you love, that, you know, what you said to me freaking hurt. And this is the reason why. There's not many people that you can be that way with. Fortunately, I have a table with my kids that I will be honest with you, and then they can be honest with me back, pausing long enough to truly listen to what they say instead of already formulating the answer of why you're wrong. And that's the hardest thing. Get them before they get you. I would have loved that. Not to say my dad never did that. Not to say that he didn't. But, you know, as a parent now, there's so much that happens that the kids see a certain side, but they don't know it all. Disassociate what they've experienced. They always say, right, there's this side, and the truth somewhere mixed in the middle. It sure in hell would have made a lot of difference if I had the one. Well, my mom, too. My mom didn't hug a lot. She was raised by a very tough German woman. And my mom was an extreme overachiever, perfectionist. She still is. And I wonder what it would be like when I would always make fun of people like your wife that would have had just super sweet and just amazing and great parents and all this. I'm like, God, boring. No, I'm kidding.
My wife's parents were not that amazing. My mother-in-law's been on the show. She walked through, much like you, she walked through some drugs and recovery. And, you know, my wife didn't have a great growing up experience. I will say, post her mom getting clean, finding Jesus, mm-hmm. kind of in that order, that my mother-in-law is fantastic. Like, I am truly blessed to have the mother-in-law I have. Not everyone, I realize, has a mother-in-law like mine. They have a monster-in-law, you know. I mean, that was kind of a famous movie in some respect.
My ex-mother-in-law, you know, before I decided I just didn't want to be with her son anymore, I was in absolute love with my mother-in-law, she and I both. Like, she didn't speak English and I didn't speak hardly any Spanish. The very first time I met her, I bought a very thick Spanish-to-English dictionary and English-to-Spanish dictionary, and we would literally sit on the couch with each other and we would thumb through the pages and point out the words to each other to try. This was before we had Google Translate, right? That's how we would literally communicate with each other, you know, because I absolutely loved her. I mean, because that's what you do when you love people. And I never understood how when you say you love somebody, how it comes with conditions. When I love you, there's not, I love you because, or I love you only if you do this. And once I started realizing I don't want to live and love by condition with somebody, that's when I truly left.
And I think that's the most powerful part, is recognizing, I'm going to steal from your brother a little bit here, recognizing that respect is no longer being served. It's time to leave the table. Well, Heather, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. Let's do some silliness together. Not play some silliness. Let's do some silliness together. So this is the part of the show where I love to do some silliness. So here it is. It's called Senseless. It's this silly little thing we do at the end of the show. I know you're not a big North Carolina fan, but they are going to be in Portland, Oregon this coming weekend. And I'm really excited because I am getting to see them live action in person in Portland. And I'm really excited to see them.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm driving 5 hours with a good friend of mine. Maybe we should binge other people's shoes. Is that weird to like listen to my own show while I'm in the car with somebody else? Is that selfish? I don't know.
No, because you can give them all the tea.
I could. I should tell them that. Like, let's binge my show.
You want to hear this? Let me tell you the real story
about what happened.
They were a little cookie.
We should do that. No, I won't do that. That seems weird to do that.
So like you do that, what I do, is like I've driven all over the place to go to concerts. Like I took my son to Austin to go see Ghost, and we went into Dallas to see Tool. I drove all the way to Houston twice to see some friends of mine open up for Sepultura and Dragon Force.
Anyway, here we are. Our silliness senseless. Okay. So I'm going to roll on your behalf. So again, I didn't get a Texas Red Raiders cup because I know you're kind of in that Houston. You're not in that Houston area. You're like more towards like Oklahoma. So I could have been like an Oklahoma State cup.
That or my brother Mark graduated from Baylor. Huge Baylor fan.
He is a Baylor Bear.
That TSU game and that Baylor game was insane.
Yes. TCU, insane. Baylor, last weekend. Good stuff.
That was a great game.
They practiced that apparently. Okay. Anyway, so people can go back and watch that. But anyway, so North Carolina Cup in honor of this weekend. I'm going to roll for you.
Okay.
All right, you got a number one. I know it looks like the North Carolina logo, but trust me, it is the number one. So here we go. Number one. Okay. It's almost like the die knew what we were talking about, by the way. A little creepy.
Okay.
A little creepy when this happens. But it says this. It says, what is something you've seen that made you laugh, smile, and cry?
Oh, my God. There's so many things on TikTok. Oh, my God. There's
good old TikTok.
There's this one with this cat, and I am an absolute fan of like animal videos. There's this cat, this black and white cat that's like walking down the deck, and it's just complaining. It's just complaining as shit, just pissed off. And the woman's like, it's okay, it's okay. And it's complaining. And it literally just veers to the left. You know, like if you were trying to see if your car's like in good balance, if you've had a front end alignment, well, this cat wasn't aligned at all. It veered to the left and it goes, and it falls off into the water. And you hear the woman in the back go, oh shit. And you can hear the cat's like, you can hear the cat is like, are you there? Where are you? And the way that it just is scolding her. You know, first of all, woman, you take me out like walking like I'm a damn dog. And then you walk me around water. Hello, I'm a cat. And then I fall off in the said water. And then you're asking me if I'm okay. No, I'm not okay. But then it always goes, what always makes me cry is always like reunion videos, like soldiers coming home, family who haven't seen each other. Just that yearning for just the togetherness and love and just enjoying people. And that always gets me. I'd sit for hours and watch things like that. It's just, that's what it's all about. You know, at the end of the day, it's not about controlling your partner. It's about loving each other. And if that at all is what your relationship is about, it's better to be with yourself, to love yourself.
If you could have anyone at a table that you could have a conversation with, who would it be? I say a table because, you know, Thanksgiving's tomorrow after all. And so this idea of coming to the table has just been resonating in my heart the whole time. I don't know why.
Well, I think it would be my mom's dad, my grandfather. He died when I was like one. And so I never got a chance to meet him. But I mean, there's pictures of me when I was a kid. But of course, you know, that was, and he passed away in 77 because I know he was a mobster. My grandfather was a part of the Irish mob. I know he was. My grandfather owned a shoe store in Chicago. My grandmother owned her own hair. He was supposed to show up for a certain meeting on Valentine's Day, and he was late. Needless to say, a bunch of the Irish mob at that time got taken out in the Valentine's Massacre. And needless to say, thus said afterwards, mom and the family moved to freaking Iowa because nothing ever happens in freaking Cedar Falls, right? Back in the freaking 50s. And then grandpa was a salesman of like silos. And
you're air quoting. Just
silos.
Air quoting.
Silos. Yeah. But I was telling mom, I was like, she would tell us about this like 6-bedroom house that they had back in the 50s. And my Uncle Tom had like a convertible Cadillac for being in high school. And they had like four or five, like a church car and this kind of car. It's like, Mom, Grandpa was in the mob still. You know, I'm telling you, he was still in the mob. And she's like, no. She was like, they would just go back to Chicago for a weekend because they were part of the big band era where they would get all dressed up in tuxes and gowns. I was like, Mom, I'm telling you, you don't sell all these turbines and freaking corn silos and stuff in Iowa and be able to afford. And he would be gone for weeks at a time. I was like, I know he was part of the mob, Mom. So I just wanted to know how my lineage was and if I needed to be talking like this or like how I need. No, that's Italian. We were supposed to be Irish, so.
I can't do Irish either. I can't do Irish, Australian, London.
Yeah, my...
Spot of tea.
As good as I get.
And that's not even that good.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. Don't try.
Heather, thanks so much for today. Thank you for letting us into your shoes.
Sure.
Really appreciate you and appreciate the fact that I think you're on an upward trajectory in a lot of respects, right? You've realized that, hey, I don't want to be there anymore and I really want to walk away from all that and really leave my kids with this lasting legacy, which I think is so important, right?
Nice to be able to get up in the morning and not be in fear. It's nice to be able to wake up with a clear head. And it's also nice to remember where shit is, not being yelled at all the time and not being felt terrible. You already sometimes talk to yourself worse than anybody. Why have another person to make it, you know, in stereo? I'm just saying.
It's a good way to look at things. Yeah. I've never thought about it.
I don't mean it in like high definition. No, no, thank you. No surround sound for this girl. So
no 4K for
no
you.
4K, no 4K yeah. of abuse. No, it's good.
Well, guys and gals, kids and campers alike, that is it. That is all. That is our show today. So here's my question, and I posed the same question to Heather that I now pose to you, and that's this. Who is that person that is not invited? Now, I noticed I said the word not invited to your table tomorrow. Who did not get the invite? Maybe you didn't write the invitation. Maybe you thought to yourself, never, ever will I ever invite that person to my table. Who is it? Got him? And you're probably like, you know what, Neil? There's nobody. I'm good. I'm practically perfect in every way. There's nobody. Everyone is welcome at my table, whether they have a drinking problem, whether they are, you know, smelly, whatever it may be. Everyone is welcome. Don't be kidding yourself. Everyone is. But I bet you if you really search hard and you search your soul and you got quiet and you got still, which is really hard to do sometimes, I bet you there would be at least one. And if so, what do you say to that one? Has enough time passed? Are you able to let go of anything? Are you ready to truly move on? Just some questions to ponder as we get out of here today. Because I think that maybe Heather feels this way and maybe you do as well, is that I'm not that person. I'm not that person that would reject somebody. I'm not that person that would keep somebody away. I'm not that person that would control somebody. I'm not, I promise. But if you are, why are you still? Something to ponder, something to think about as we go into the Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States. I always have to clarify that because sometimes, you know, we have some international folks that are like, what are you talking about, this Thanksgiving thing? Just to be clear on that. So also, don't forget this. Don't ever, ever forget. Remember, when you walk in other people's shoes, you really do get a different perspective on life. Thank you so much for listening. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Stay tuned till next week when we walk in other people's shoes.